evening, everybody, and welcome back. I think we've had a really nice chat and meal and everything. It's certainly very convivial on our table. And this is the last session of the Members' Day, and we're continuing the panel discussion. Only for this session, we're broadening the discussion to include anything relating to epistemology. We're going to conclude this by 9, but if you kind of run out of questions before then, we won't drag it out sort of unnecessarily. If it turns out people would rather carry on discussing things in the bar, then that's fine. But at any rate, we will finish by 9 o'clock. That's all right, you panel people. But first of all, I'd like to ask if there are anybody has got questions from the last session that they either didn't get a chance to ask or would like to follow up on. Yeah.
Okay, I'm Jean Morris. I wanted to ask Peter just about the last paragraph where he says that justification is about politics and rivals and experts in power, whereas understanding and explanation is about trying to understand and physics. And I don't understand why this distinction. Why can't justification be about metaphysics and explanation be about power equally well? And also, how does this play out vis-a-vis science, where you have justification for everything in the experimental method?
That's a nice question. Well, what I'm saying is maybe an oversimplification. but I just sort of have a sort of gut feeling that hang on. Sorry, mine's all blank in there. I'm sorry, absolutely lost the plot. Give me a clue as to the question, which I'll get out, I'll come back.
Your distinction between justification and explanation, one bad, one good. I mean, you see justification as a power play almost.
Oh, yeah, yes, it's this thing, the politics one way, the metaphysics the other. I'm with you now. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. Sorry, sort of senior moment there. The claim that justification is about politics, that effectively that's what my paper was about. Well, it wasn't a paper, was it? But that was the whole line of the argument, was that you start off with this confident feeling that there is justification is some real solid thing, either you've got justification, you haven't, and scientists have got justification and we haven't, and all this kind of stuff. And then this thought about the bar slipping up and down has poisoned my mind to the point where I think, actually, this justification game it's a game, you know.
Understand it's almost like a prejudice.
Yeah, because if you put forward a view and you say, have you got a justification? Tell me your justification.
Yeah.
You know, and you give me a reason for your belief.
Yeah.
Then the question is, okay, does Jean know this thing? Right? And then
I could be quoting somebody else. It doesn't have to be me. I could refer to the scientific evidence, or I could refer to a consensus
but that's sort of conceding the game to me, isn't it? Because if you're having to yes, it is.
Public faith, justification.
Well, I'm assuming that what you're defending is that a justification is a justification. You know, that there's no social sort of context in which a justification occurs. So if you give me a justification, then presumably your position is that's a justification. I don't need to defer to authorities or anyone because the justification speaks for itself.
Yeah.
And that's the thing I'm sort of uneasy about. Justifications don't seem to speak for themselves. You know, I'm inclined to say, put it really, but I mean, who are you? What's your
mind justification? Pardon? And why do explanations not speak for themselves in exactly the same way?
Well, one thing at a time. I mean, I said that's why I've got this rather relativist notion of justification. Okay, and then I mean, we can take your question apart. But I mean, a perfectly reasonable question is does the same argument that I've used against justification, maybe it applies to explanation?
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I perfectly accept that. I catalogue sort of eight problems of explanation and justification. One of them sneaked into the middle was maybe the whole damn thing is relative, you know, and then what counts as a good explanation. But, I mean, at the back of my mind, which I haven't really referred to, is the Aristotelian notion of an explanation is the notion that there are facts in the world which explain, you know, that's what we're all fishing for, is some sort of objectivity. And actually what I'm thinking is, I want to know what the world's like, so I want some sort of objectivity. And really what's behind my talk is that if you go for justification, you get trapped in all this sort of social contextual thing.
Well, I guess we just have different, to me, justification would be facts in the world.
Okay, well, we might end up, if we spend half an hour on this, we might end up talking about the same thing, you know. But what I'm fishing for is the notion that there is something out there. You say, what is it, you know, we had an example of the tsunami, you know.
Yeah.
And you say, what is the explanation of a tsunami? You know, what's your justification for views about tsunami? Well, I've read a book about it or something, you know. But what's the explanation of a tsunami? You've got to start talking about what's going on at the bottom of the earth. You've got to get down to the facts, you know. So that's what... Okay.
Thanks, maybe.
So, well, if we agree, that's great, because...
Thank you, Gene. Would anybody else like to come in on that? No? Oh, okay. Do you have questions?
I just had a comment on that very point.
Yeah, go on.
I think to support what Peter said, if I understand right, Thomas Kuhn's idea of a paradigm would include not just fundamental beliefs about the world, but also the measures by which we would judge a statement to be valid or not. And therefore the justification was actually part of, the criteria for justification was built into the idea of a paradigm. So his concept is that when there's a scientific revolution, one paradigm is replaced by another, which in itself is a power play sort of thing. It's about replacing the figures of authority, for example, in the Christian church, at the time of Kepler and Copernicus, with a different view of reality, where we judge statements and the value of them in a different sense. So they're no longer judged by a religious context, but in more of an empirical context. And therefore, I think the question of the judgment of a statement is a power play, whereas understanding, I just be more subjective thing, more the personal thing. So I think I'm
okay. Anybody want to respond to that? Yeah. Happy with that?
Okay,
yeah, okay. Let me just come back to you in a minute. And your question?
Me?
Yeah.
I think I'm learning it small satisfaction. There's a question from an eye for this. During the whole of your talk and the previous one, I found myself thinking about Goethe in the beginning was the act or the deed.
Could you speak up, Anne, please?
Yeah, in the beginning was the act or the deed, or how he translates it. One of the things that doesn't seem to have appeared anywhere, if we're asking ourselves questions about how do I know, is the idea of practice, the idea of doing. And it seems to me that, if you like, everyday activity had answered the question, how do I know, long before philosophers have got around to asking it, really. And how do I know is by, well, I think this is the case. I try it out. If it works, it might be the case. And if it doesn't, I try something else. And therefore, it does seem to me that the idea of practice and doing as a measure of do I know this or do I not is rather important, isn't it?
Yeah, John?
So... great point. It appears to me you're running two things together there. So we have this distinction between knowing how and knowing that now in philosophy.
Yeah. Both are helped by pragmatism.
Well, obviously, a knowing that will necessarily presuppose certain practices which give the concepts in question their sense, because, well, at least from my view, you'd have to have the practices to give anything any kind of sense, but not in the same way as the knowing how. That is to say, the knowing how might be something that's not a proposition. It isn't expressible simply in that clauses, where the knowing that would be. I know that such and such is the case, for your example then, needn't be ascertained by attention purely to practice. My knowledge of how to engage in a religious practice, for example, to go back to my discussion, might be arguable to be a form of knowing how, in that I don't know that such and such is the case, but I know how to engage in a certain practice, which is part of a wider set of interlinked epistemological claims, or part of a wider epistemological system. So, I mean, the two are connected, but it's not the case that the knowing that is, as you said, know that such as case is explained by the practice, rather the two could be quite distinguishable. But it would be the case that any kind of that clause, at least in my view, is engaged as part of a practice, both of which could be interrelated.
I'm not sure from that that I've picked out properly what you see as the difference between knowing that and knowing how. But, I mean, if I think of, well, just like the Molinari illusion, because we were talking about earlier, how do people know, as opposed to suffer from the illusion?
Well, that might be a different question. Okay, the question of how do I know is not necessarily a case of knowing how. Knowing how could be something that's not expressible in straight propositions. Yeah, so I might not be able to express my knowing how to be in the world, my knowing how to engage in certain activities, my knowing how to engage in philosophical practice might not be simply break down. I might just break that down into a simple set of propositions that show, you know, if you do all these things, then you have that know-how. Know-how could be something beyond that. Let me think of a better example. So, I mean, this is a problem that phenomenology faces, certainly in the continental tradition, to try and explain how it is, to try and explain the very human way of being, what it is to be human, what it is to engage in certain practices, and just break these down in some attempts into propositions and say this is what it is to be human. Whereas these might involve certain processes of knowing how, which you can't just analyse in this way. They're only known, as it were, from the inside, from within the practice, and you can't break it down to a set of that clauses, that if you do X, and that if that is the case, and that is the case, then you have a description of what it is to be human. It can be inimitably...
Is that a question?
Non-proposition.
How can I be human?
I'm not sure it's a question that makes sense.
It doesn't make sense.
But phenomenology generally...
I don't know how not to be a human.
Okay, but phenomenology, that would be phenomenology that's very base. You could have, as it were, phenomenology of seeing certain colours or of acting in a particular way. Now, I mean, so as it were, you can break the two apart somewhat. And so to know how to do, you gave the case of, you said that knowing how to engage in this or knowing how to do this isn't necessarily a case of knowing how, because there might be cases where the know-how could be reducible to a knowing that, whereas there are cases where the two might be quite separable, where a knowing how is not necessarily a know how to X. That's quite hard for me to...
One example of that, the difference between knowing how to get to the Albert Hall and knowing how to ride a bicycle. First one could be put in propositional form. Second one, not so easily.
Fantastic example. Yeah. Okay, so
what's that example?
The difference between two different... an example of knowing how that can be translated into propositional form and one that can't.
But an example of knowing that cannot?
Your example, Frank, again.
The example of knowing how that is difficult to translate into any sort of propositional form is knowing how to swim or how to ride the bicycles. But knowing how to get to the Albert Hall can quite easily be put in propositional form. you get the number 9 bus and get off at so and so, and you walk 100 yards, and on the right there is the other four.
Yeah. I understand the difference, but what's the point of making widows?
Isn't it the difference between knowledge and understanding?
Yeah. So, Frank, did you want to...
The whole
significance of this is to the question we originally asked, which was, should we look to the knowing how here? Sorry, well, if I misunderstood the question, what was the question?
Perhaps badly formulated, was that what I've missed in the whole of the first two sessions, in particular, was any reference to practice.
The
idea that somehow we only knew there was a problem about, you know, whether this was the case or that was the case when philosophers started formulating it as a problem seems to me to be wrong. We knew these things, you know, we knew there was a problem about, I don't know, measuring that, the root of the thing, before anybody came up with ideas about, well, I suppose the calculus type ideas, there are ways of measuring these things, which you can do it that way if it's this, you can do it that way if it's this. People knew these things through practice before theorists started trying to put them into theory. That's my point.
I mean, that's the point I was trying, when Mike asked me a question about prediction, that was sort of my reply, was that actually knowledge seems to me to be more closely related to what you do, and then as you just said, it's sort of understand, you know, the question of, you know, did the Egyptians understand how to deal with the flooding of the Nile or something? By gosh, yes they did, you know. But I mean, you can't just talk about action. We're here to study epistemology, so what is the sort of knowledge-y type prerequisite for action, you know, and I'm peddling the line that understanding is the thing you need.
Epistemology came second.
Epistemology is articulating it. You could hardly say that the Egyptians could have sorted out the flooding of the Nile if they didn't understand it.
No, in the course of trying to solve it, they came to understand it.
I presume surely you solve the problem. Surely you understand. Understanding comes, you know, if you're trying to sort out the plumbing, you suddenly understand. Say, oh, I think we better tighten this nut here. Understanding comes.
Try doing things. That's what Kirsch was on about when he says in the beginning is that
you. You're not a very good plumber if you just sort of.
Are there any other points just to do with this knowing how and knowing that? Mike?
If I may, I think I understand the question you were asking, but you didn't ask it right. This is just
probably
thank you. Gentlemen, what I missed, and I think what Anne missed, was any attempt to move out of the subjective point of view. All of the theory of epistemology you were talking, particularly Frank, was how do I subjectively know that this is a true experience? So, heck, I ask somebody else, or I poke it with my finger, which is what unfortunately meant by it. But also, insofar as any talk about thought experiments which manipulate my brain in such a way that I still see the object there which is no longer there, well, I'm sorry, you just manipulate a part of my brain because my retina is not receiving anything. And that's just as part of me as anything else. What I'm saying is that this insistence the Western philosophy has on taking purely subjective point of view, here is a philosopher sitting, thinking and answering questions, is wrong. That is not what we do in practice. In practice, we social beings, we answer those questions collectively. That's your point, isn't it?
Yes. That's primary in the other secondary.
Right.
I'm confused over what you mean here by we're answering these questions in the practices, or these questions weren't there in the practices. Is it not the case that the questions didn't arise? Then, well, the distinction you're asking for here is that so you have this knowing how and engaging practices and the issues that arise. That's about justification. You just get on with it, as it were. And then the questions arise when we actually start philosophizing about these things and raise the question, then they become a concern for us. So I'm confused as to why it seems the way you're painting it is that the ancient Egyptians had it all right and now we've got into a muddle about these things. And it seems to me that now we're just, because we're perhaps raising questions that maybe weren't raised then. Okay, so, I'm trying to make sense of this question.
Is your question on this same point? Specific. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
How would you categorise knowing that? I mean, knowing what it's called. Is it a knowing that? I'm thinking particularly of in Dickens' Hard Times, polemic against utilitarianism. The young girl Sissy, who was brought up in the circus and knew all about horses, but she was sent to the bottom of the class because she didn't know what a quadruped was. Which illustrates it really nicely.
Yeah.
So knowing what it's called, what's that? Is that knowing that?
Well, I mean, in a nutshell, you can understand knowing that simply by whether the proposition being expressed in a that clause in a sound grammatical way. So, I know that such and such is the case. I know that a, what was the example you have?
A horse is a quadruped.
I know that a horse is a quadruped. I can express it in fact. I know how a horse is a quadruped would be a very different, I'm not sure if that makes proper sense, but I know how to ride a bike is very different from I know that a bike has two wheels. Okay, the knowledge is of a different kind.
It's concept, isn't it?
It even involves
a
the knowing how it can involve a particular practice with activity that then isn't clearly expressible in the proposition in that clause, whereas the knowing that could just be a piece of information, a fact.
Yeah.
Chris, is your point
on
the same thing?
Yes, I just wanted to give an example. So the development of thermodynamics grew out of the building of steam engines. They knew how to build steam engines. Thermodynamics came along to explain it. But landing a man on the moon relied entirely on classical mechanics and our science. And that was the other way around. So sometimes knowing that leads to knowing the power and the other way around. It just depends on the
On the knowing that and the knowing how, there was a very interesting experiment done here at the Radcliffe a year or so ago. They were addressing this exact problem about how and that, and they're trying to work out how do you differentiate, and they decided these were neuroscientists, and they had students, so they decided 50 or whatever more students, they would set them over a 6-month period to learn how to juggle. And over that 6-month period, they did juggling every half an hour every day, and they were put into the most advanced scanner again every week or every few days or whatever, and see what was happening. And what happened was that, not surprisingly, all the changes were in the motor cortex, which is near the back, the part of the brain controlling motor activity. And certain areas lit up, but gradually over the 6 months, as these people's skills improved, the subsidiary areas gradually disappeared, and they ended up with a module in a certain area that could grow larger all the time. Interestingly, the module was in precisely the same place in the motor cortex of every student. So that this settled two things, anyway, one thing. The basic thing was, is information a concept, if there were information stored all over the brain, widely stored, which is one theory, and certainly part is, or is some or all stored in modules? This one is clearly modular. The important thing was, though, if they talked to those students about, and they were now quite expert at juggling, if you asked them how do they do it, they had the faintest idea. Because the motor cortex information was stored in such a way that they couldn't get at it propositionally to explain it.
Thank you.
What would be, simple question, what would be the difference between knowing that the Nile floods once a year, how it floods once a year, and why it floods? Or is there...
We should
only conflate how and why.
We should make sure the distinction is drawn between knowing that and knowing how to. So it's usually... Knowing how to usually concerns, as it were, an activity that one engages in. So the activity of juggling. Knowing how the Nile floods is... might be then break that down into a form of knowing that, because you could break it down into a set of propositions that tell you how the Nile floods. So it's knowing how to is the way to phrase it. And that then refers to the action, the personal verb, doing something, which is clearly a different form of knowledge to knowing that, because it involves activity.
Yeah. Jean, I think?
I thought Anne's point was the use of action in epistemologically. So, for example, the bent stick, the way we learn that it's not really bent is we go and we handle it. And we touch it. And that was completely left out.
to know how to discover.
It's not to do with knowing how. It's to do. You don't only look at things. You said you had distinguished between an illusion and very, 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 very. But the way we do that, I don't recall you saying, which is very often to handle it.
But I missed the bit of your. It sounded like fence dip, but I.
Bent stick.
Oh, bent stick. I beg your pardon. Right.
But what's I'm sorry. Still confused as what this really shows. That what
I thought Anne's point of when she mentioned action wasn't anything to do with how to. I thought it was that action, and anyway, my point that action had been left out of the epistemological picture, and in fact, it's a very important ingredient
right.
in how we are.
Well, if that's the question, the whole knowing how to know that distinction is actually quite is relatively new as a kind of theme in cases we've dealt with. So,
well, what about the action point then? Do you want to respond to Jean's point then?
We've
ignored action.
I'd like Jean to tell us what exactly she was missing. I'm just trying to think about what I said rather than what the other said. And how, or Anne's point. How should we have, what was missing? How did we not fit action in? Where was it appropriate to talk about action in our talks?
I may have missed something, but one of you said the difference between illusion and non-illusion, and implying that this had been discussed, but I missed the discussion, because I missed any way of distinguishing between illusion and the real thing. The whole emphasis was on how similar they were. And the difference is very often done by handling the object, which is an action, or by interacting with it physically. It's to be on theory and practice. I didn't hear any practice.
Is your point of the solution to the argument for illusion, what would be to go and grab the stick out of the water and then...
Do any of the panel want to come in on
that? I think there's an ongoing difficulty about understanding the difference between illusion and delusion, insofar as illusion can sometimes lead to us getting a wrong picture of reality, but sometimes it doesn't. In the case of the Muller liar, illusion, or the bent stick, illusion, we can be perfectly aware of what the situation is and know that we are getting a picture of the world as the world is not. But from the point of view of the argument from illusion, it doesn't matter whether we are also deluded, so long as our senses are telling us something that's wrong. Sometimes they can tell us something that's wrong, and actually it can lead to unfortunate circumstances. For example, a bit like the bent stick, people who are spearfishing in Polynesia say, if they aimed their spear at where they saw the fish, they would starve. They actually have to correct for that, but they are, as a matter of fact, not deluded. So there are action consequences of illusion, but only when it's accompanied by delusion. I don't know if that cuts through any of what the problems were.
No, okay, I'm going to ask Eileen now.
It's not a very clear thought. You've had the discussions of propositional knowledge, knowing that and knowing how. But I think the worries that have been arising, particularly from Jean saying, well, how do you know whether the stick is bent right? You grab it. And I think that this is the question underlying what Pike was talking about. Direct realism is the idea that, you know, the world impinges on us. And that's where our knowledge comes from. It's by interacting with these solid objects that we get our knowledge. Now, that's not propositional knowledge, but it's probably at the heart of what underlies the worries that you were talking about.
No, but it's intentional knowledge, as propositional knowledge is, and almost all perceptual knowledge can be turned into propositional knowledge, but some can't.
I agree with that. I agree with that. But it, I think Jean are probably missing is this interaction with the world without the mediation of something going on in our heads. We just do it. I mean, little kids just get on with it. They don't think. They just do it.
Well, I think that's the strength of the naive realist
view. It is.
View.
It's a very strong view.
And it's something that disjunctivism has come back to.
It's the strength of the motor cortex rather than
But then, disjunctivism seems so strange because it seems either trite or obvious. Either we're seeing or perceiving correctly or we're not. I mean, so what? Yeah, we all knew that. But that is their reaction to the argument from illusion, or particularly the argument from hallucination. But they try not to lose sight of this fact that perception, all are, I mean, touch, taste, as well as sight. I've just used sight to try and typify all the senses, which isn't quite the correct thing to do. But what I said right at the beginning was that there is this strong intuition about perceptual experience, that it represents an openness to the world. It is the only way through which we get our knowledge of the world, all empirical knowledge.
But it's the world coming in on us rather than us sitting inside our little cocoon and going out to the world. You know, it's a different, it's the opposite to the Cartesian perspective than I
really
perspective. It's from the world to us and not the other way around.
Christians, are, or I think it was you who said, that an awful lot of things supervene on that experience. Such that, you know, there might be shadows, the quality of the lights, all the rest of it affects our perception. So that jumps back to where you were saying that the intentionalists, what does it say here, can also misrepresent objects or even represent non-existent objects. Is there not a sense in which because so much supervenes, our perception must be distorted?
I think you're actually mixing two different points here. The representationalists or intentionalists get round the argument from illusion, which is difficult for sensate theorists who can accept it, because their objects of perception are the sense data, and that is certain and immediate. Representationalists say, no, we haven't got direct, certain perception of individual things. We merely represent them. So that allows them to say, and we can also misrepresent them, which the sense data theorists can't say about sense data.
But is it not, it's not can misrepresent, but must misrepresent?
Well, sometimes, only in terms when the perception is not veridical. The supervenience point came in when we were talking about disjunctivists to explain their externalism, because they say that the experience of perceptual experience of something includes the thing itself. It supervenes not just on the mental experience, but it supervenes on the whole of my connection with the object over there.
Okay, right, Chris?
I was just intrigued by these remarks about the straight stick. So first of all, I'd like to say, you cannot tell by any means I can think of that a stick is straight just by holding it. You can't tell by touch that it's straight. Similarly, you can't tell a stick is straight by looking at it, particularly like me, you suffer from astigmatism in both arms. But even if you've got perfect eyesight, whatever that is to be, which I think is an ideologically corrected by opticians who have a particular sort of view of the world that they impose on the rest of it. But even if you take a stick, right, and look at it, it can look straight from one angle and not from another. So it's a very interesting question, and it's an epistemological question. How do you actually tell if the stick is straight? My thinking about this, I'm thinking, well, I need a standard. I need another stick, which has been defined to be straight, you know, the standard of straightness. And then, if I take the two sticks, Then by touch, I can check to see if there's a gap between them and I put it together.
That's
and there you go, a bit of a psychological analysis here. But it's actually, you know, you can go and you can go on for a couple of hours. How do you tell if a stick is
Okay, I'm going to take Patrick, and then I
still got Dallas.
I just wanted Frank's response to the idea that you say that the stick, you see an illusion when it's in that particular medium, yeah, because it's bent. How do you respond to say, well, to anyone with a knowledge of physical principles, would a physics so that would understand that the light behaves in certain ways through different mediums, and so to that person it's not an illusion at all because it's exactly what you would expect.
Yeah.
So in fact, if I saw a stick in water which looked straight, for me that would be the illusion. in a sense, does that affect your argument at all anyway?
No, because it doesn't look straight. It looks bent. The fact that you know why it looks bent, the fact that you know why the two lines in the Moulin-Lau illusion look unequal, except to isn't the case. What we're trying to get at is the fact that things look differently from how they are. That's all.
Well, when you say
sometimes, and that comes back to my previous.
But when you say how they are, you're taking the stick out of context. The stick is in a context. It's in water.
Yeah.
It's a much larger context, and that's my point. Really, is that I have a problem with when you take something out of context like that.
All I'm saying is
you're setting up an absolute, I suppose.
Give me a straight stick. We all know it's straight. Look, you know, magician on the stage, it's straight.
Yeah.
Stick it in water. Ooh, it looks bent. Not, as simple as that, that's all.
Sure. But I'm not going to an illusion.
Shall we have a... I'm sorry to be the resident Wittgenstein here. We surely have a meaning for the word illusion, right, in an ordinary sense. Someone says there's an illusion there, it looks bent. Do you know what they mean? You also have this further sense to you with your knowledge of physical principles. To you, in another sense, it isn't an illusion. But if you said to them, it isn't an illusion, they wouldn't have a clue what you meant by that if they had not the knowledge. You would be referring back to somebody talking past one of these.
Well, again, there's a social context here, then, isn't
it? It doesn't call into question whether it's an illusion or not. It just gives a further meaning to this word.
Yeah, but there is a problem with that, surely, because we aren't actually pursuing the speak, and that's one aspect of the whole thing that's been missing from this. In that we are perceiving light reflected
on one way of looking at
your sense data theory, something.
If you want to say that what we're really perceiving is this, that we don't actually perceive a stick in water that's brown in colour or something, if you want to cling to that view, by all means do, but I mean that's patently false. You really do see a stick.
Things are warming up here. Yeah.
The difference is seeing and perceiving.
I mean,
what you see.
You can give what you see. You can give what it just seems to me you've got different modes of description here. Okay, so when you say what are you looking at here, you can describe it in various ways depending on what knowledge and what different systems you have of looking at it are. But if you're then going to deny, no, I don't see a pen in front of me, then that's going to... You might mean... We could look at what you mean by that. Okay, I don't really see a pen in front of me, I really see this. But then, again, we're talking different ways here. If you want to say, look, we're engaging a practice where we talk about what we say, because that has really important and practical use here. That when we say, referring to a problem that Heraclitus dealt with, when we say that you can't step into the same... Heraclitus claims you can't step in the same river twice. You're constantly moving body of water, right? That would have no practical use, that way of defining a river. A river is defined as a constantly moving body of water. We call it a river even though it's constantly moving. And we're not going to do away with that if we say there's another way of looking at a mode of description. We're going to keep that because it has practical benefits. We have no practical benefits to say this isn't straight or this isn't a pen or something if you have this further mode of description. it's another way of describing it. And so we're not against one another here.
But I'm not talking about mode of description. I'm talking, as Peter quite rightly points, at the distinction between seeing and perceiving.
Perception. That's the difference.
Yeah. How does that difference play on this? I don't see how it does.
No. Okay, I'm going to take a couple more questions, Nigel.
Your wife was very into Chris's thing. I remember being taught by my woodwork master that you can tell if the people were distraught by looking along it. It was something I was taught.
That assumed you got the same way.
And it's something I think about. But I'm also remembering that a conversation about bicycles and nobody relates to the juggling as well. I remember trying to teach my son to cycle, and there was no way I could use any words to actually help sort of do it. You know, what I had to do was hold on the back of the saddle and run, and I was never quite fit enough to do it. But it seems to me there are certain things, and maybe the example with the horses, you know, the girl who knew how to ride the horses. It's actually just getting in there and experience. And there are a number of things that we deal with which we simply cannot adequately express in words. And I do wonder whether we as philosophers get sort of too caught up with this business of words. Because there are an awful lot of things which we do without words. When Charles was talking earlier about this business of concept, I was thinking about concepts I deal with as an architect, and there are lots of things I'm having to do which I simply cannot put into words. The reason we use drawing, you will see, is that there are a number of things that you can't adequately express in words, or if you can, it is so impossibly complicated that no one can solve it. So not everything is done in words, and yet we tend to try and push everything into words.
Okay. I'm going to wrap up the discussion now, but I hope the panel will be happy to sort of just stone in the bar for a few minutes.
So someone buys drinks.
Yeah. Sounds a fair bet to me. So we won't say this is the end of the discussion, but it's just going to move to a different place. And I'm going to conclude this part of the day by just a word of thanks, first of all, to our four fantastic presenters who have, you know, done a really brilliant job and been so good at dealing with the questions as well. So I think we should all give you a big also a big vote of thanks to Phil Rees, who isn't here, who sort of set up the whole organisation of the speakers and the subject and sorted all that out with all of you. And it's a sad thing that Phil can't be here today, because he's not very well. But then finally, another big vote of thanks to Eileen, who's done all the work. One.